originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone. Good afternoon and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. This is indeed Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I, of course, am Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, coming to you once again from our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios, and do want to extend a very special welcome to everyone throughout HRN Nation, including all of you listening to us live throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM Channel 201, and all of you tuned in to our free live streaming or the archived podcast of this show, which is available on our HRN website, horseracingradio.net. Really happy to have you along for the ride as I visit with another trainer who is just really getting started with his training career. He has worked with some very prominent trainers and learned from some prominent trainers. He comes from a racing family, and the guest on tonight's show is a native of the Finger Lakes region in New York. Now, he's 34 years old, and I mentioned he comes from a racing family, but he's learned from Gary Contessa. He's learned from David Fox before recently going out on his own. Combined, Gary Contessa and David Fox have saddled more than 3,300 winners in their careers. Well, 1 month ago, on December 6th, our guest moved one win closer to catching his mentors when he saddled his first career winner at Gulfstream Park, and he did it with style that day. 15-1 upsetter Sarasota Boy crossed the wire first, and please join me in welcoming tonight's guest on Trainer Talk. That is trainer Scott Acker. Scott, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, happy to have you aboard.
Glad I could be here.
Yeah, looking forward to the visit and looking forward to hearing your story, but let's not bury the lead. Let's start with that huge win on December 6th. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah, how cool was that?
It was special. It really was. More so, I mean, it was my first, but it was also the horse's first. And I've been with that horse since he came from the farm, so it's very gratifying when they win like that.
Where'd you watch the race?
Right at the wire, actually.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. I said, you know, I never usually do that. Usually I go to a TV off in the corner, but I was like, you know what? I want to be right out here. I want to see it live. So.
How about the moments before the race, coming into the paddock, you know, the hours before the race? Were you nervous? Did you have time to be nervous?
You know what? Like, I guess that's where my experience comes into play. I've worked for so many people, like you had already mentioned, that, obviously you're always nervous no matter what kind of race it is or what the whole situation is. But no, I was pretty confident. I mean, he'd been training so much better, and the rider knew him at that time pretty well. So I knew we were going in on a better foot than we had been the last few times.
All right, put me there with you, next to the wire, as you mentioned. We're standing there together. What am I going to see when I'm watching Scott Acker watch this race?
slapping my leg pretty hard. trying to act professional and not make too much of a scene, but I mean, you just can't help yourself. It's so exciting. I don't care who you are. It's so much fun.
All right. So when you finally realize he's the winner, how about that moment? What's that moment like for a trainer?
That was, I mean, of course, it was my first time as a trainer, so it was really special. I mean, I was pretty welled up inside, but I'm like, okay, I got to take it easy. And I was just more happy. It was so, because it was a big team effort, if you will. That owner, he used to be with Dave Fox. He gave me an opportunity, which was awesome. So he stuck by me. The rider, Fanny, she comes and gets on him all the time, and she knew him. So it was a big, a lot of teamwork that went into it. It was really fun.
You mentioned trying to be reserved and professional. I don't know if I could do that, man. I think all that would go out the window. If I'm a trainer, and I've never trained a horse, but if my horse wins and I win my first race, I think you got to let it out.
I know. I was excited. Don't get me wrong. But, yeah, I don't know. It's just something that's been like kind of a – my grandfather was like that too. He's like, you know, just keep cool. Always keep your composure. So it's always in the back of my mind, and I just want to make sure, you know. That way, if you keep your composure, you can do your job appropriately. You know, I go out to the track, watch the horse come back. He jogged back great. He looked great. He was happy. Everything was great.
Yeah, and it wasn't like you had to sweat out a photo finish. Sarasota Boy
No.
Won easy.
That's what Fanny and I talked about in the beginning of the race, because he's still very, very green. I mean, he was on the wrong lead. His head was still in the air, and he still won by three. So I was very excited about it, but still wasn't the right way yet. So he's still learning. And I said, you know what, Fanny, I think we're going to have to use him at some point in the race, obviously. But let's try to use him early in the race.
Yeah, and that's Jockey.
You can get better position.
Jockey Fanny Olson, of course, who you're referring to. Why was she such a good fit? You said she had been on him and knew the horse. Why was she such a good fit?
You know, like I saw that horse at Croupies, and he's always had pretty strong riders on him because he's a pretty, you know, burly kind of colt. And it was almost like the exact opposite is what he wanted. Fanny, you know, obviously is a woman, and she's got very light and nice hands, and she does more working with him and coaxing him rather than trying to like make him do it. You know what I mean? She lets it be his idea, which has been working out great.
Yeah, it's outstanding. And what a moment for you. And I know there's more to come. That's just the beginning.
Absolutely. I hope.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you bet on him at 15-1?
No, sir. Absolutely not.
I'm
so superstitious with that. I cannot bet my own. Nope.
Well, you have my phone number now, so next time you send out a horse that's live at 15-1, I expect a text.
No problem.
Hey, let's clarify this, too. That was not your first starter. It was actually your seventh starter in your career. Your first starter came July 21st at Gulfstream. Take me back to that day when you're saddling the first horse in your name, and you know that this is your operation. What was that day like for you, Scott?
That was more nerve-wracking than the race. I actually thought I had a real chance in.
Yeah.
You know, you just want everything to go right. You don't want any hiccups. You don't want any mishaps. You want them, you know, get around there, hopefully put forth their best effort and come back safe and sound. Everybody, all horses in the race. So, and that, we did accomplish that, and that was actually fun too, even though she didn't finish very well. But it was still pretty gratifying to actually reach that point finally.
Yeah, really special, and again, congratulations on that huge win and that huge day at Gulfstream Park, and we'll look forward to seeing your name and your pictures in the winner's circle much more often moving forward. Let's go back to the beginning here, Scott. I told you that this show focuses so much on you and how you got started and being around horses for the first time. I mentioned that you come from a racing family, so take me back to the very beginning and your childhood and being around horse racing and around horses.
You're right. I'm from Finger Lakes, and my grandfather actually trains horses. And ironically enough, he's the only one that does anything with the horses in our family. So even my own mom, she was, why don't you try doing something else? And I was always just getting on my bike, and I only lived like a mile down the road. So I'd ride over there, or my grandpa would come pick me up as often as possible. And I just loved being at the track. It was awesome. And I knew fairly young that that's what I wanted to do. And I think I was pretty fortunate because my grandfather was a trainer, so he didn't, you know, he let things happen and evolve instead of, like, making you do things and putting a sour taste in your mouth. But he always left the door open. He said, the track's always going to be there. You can always try something else. But I just, nope, not a chance.
You never wanted to do anything else?
Nope. I don't know why. I love the horses.
What other things did you try? I know that you had to try a few other things.
You know what I tried one time is a golf course. What do you call it? I don't even know what they call it. Where you drive around the golf carts.
Oh, yeah.
The bag room.
Yeah, sure.
The bag room. Yes. I tried that for like a month, and I was like, no, I'm sorry. I can't do this.
Wait a minute.
Just to appease my parents.
That's the only other job you ever had outside of racing.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely.
Wow. You know, isn't it incredible the way that when this sport gets into your blood like that? I mean, I took a break. I was working at Thoroughbred Times, which is now no longer in business. I left there, did things outside of racing for a very short period, but I had to get back involved and do something with the sport in some fashion. I couldn't be away from it.
Yeah. I mean, it's the horses and the people that it brings around, too. I mean, not just saying the owners, but just you're a pretty tight-knit family in a sense. Like, it's pretty closed-circuit community, the racing community, I think, personally. And you don't even have to be born in it. That's why it's such a cool sport, too. Like, I know I feel like I'm privileged because I was, but I've seen people walk on the track, not like it, but a lot of them fall right in love with it. And, I mean, they never look back either. It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you said, it's in their blood, and that's it. It gets in your blood, and goodbye.
So your parents, were they a big fan of you being involved in the sport and working in the industry?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. They've always had my back in anything I've done. And I left home. As soon as I graduated high school, I left. I couldn't wait to go see other tracks and other horses and all that other stuff. And they never tried to stop me. They let me do whatever. Now, actually, they just left a few days ago. They came down here, and they love going to Gulfstream Park. So
I'm sure
they're
getting
into it more, too.
Yeah. Will they bet on the horses that you train?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a couple bucks here and there, you know, but still, it's fun. They get a big kick out of it.
Yeah, that's great. Talking with trainer Scott Acker here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. As you heard, just getting started with his training career. We're going to talk about his time with Gary Contessa and his time with David Fox. They were obviously a major influence, but you mentioned your grandfather, Edward. He was obviously a major influence too. Tell me more about him and his training operation and being around his operation as a kid.
It was, you know, it was a lot to take in because, again, it's your grandfather, it's your family, so you're expected to do better than most. So you always were kind of more under the gun than everybody else, but it was good for you. It was a good experience to grow up under like that. He was a good, a very, very good caretaker of his horses. Like, you know, they all got brushed off to them. I mean, baby oil noses, that kind of stuff. Like, it was every day. Just, you know, it's not walk in there and just slap on bandages. Everything was very particular, and he had a certain way of doing things, and it seemed to work for me too. So, and then as I moved on, I went to a bigger barns, and you learn, you know, more of how to run a business more so than just the actual care and caring part.
Where did your grandfather train? Finger Lakes?
Strictly Finger Lakes. I think he'd ship around here and there, but yeah, Finger Lakes. He's still there now.
Is he really? Well, I noticed that when you look him up on Equibase, it shows that he's saddled 235 winners in his career. And, you know, he's had several horses that have earned upwards of $40,000. Is that kind of his sweet spot where he's been able to make his living?
Yes, absolutely. And he owned most of them, too, which was the cool thing. So, like, that was all sometimes stressful, but very gratifying when he did well. So that was good. He never wanted to get super big. He just kept a handful of horses where he could manage it. I mean, he owns horses now still to this day. He just obviously can't keep training. He's a little older, but yeah, he can't get out of it either.
What do you think he taught you that you still keep in mind today when you're starting your own operation?
Be honest with yourself and everybody around you. Pretty much, basically, like, you know, you just can't do bad business with anybody, especially in this kind of game.
Yeah.
You leave a bad taste in someone's mouth, and you don't know how far that's going to spread. So you just, you know, you just be honest and do what you think is right.
Did you have a favorite horse of his when you were growing up that maybe you got to work with a little bit or just be around?
Oh, yeah. Broadway Blondie was her name. She was big chestnut horse with a white blaze. I think Finger Lakes used to have quarter horse races, believe it or not, for thoroughbred, or quarter mile races, I should say. And she still holds the record, I think, for the fastest quarter at Finger Lakes, which is kind of funny. But she was really sweet, nice big mare that, you know, you could do anything with her, and she just always perform for you.
Yeah, and she was honest too. I'm actually looking at her statistics right now. She started 57 times with 11 wins, 11 seconds, and 5/3, and earned nearly $100,000 in purse money. That's not too shabby, you know, racing back in the, you know, early 2000s, especially at Finger Lakes, right?
Mm-hmm.
But how cool is it to have a horse like that and to be around a horse like that that's so honest and shows up and runs their race every time?
Excuse me?
How cool is it to be around a horse like that, that is so honest and just runs the race every time?
It's awesome. I mean, it's when you race so many horses, when you bring horses over like that, I don't know, you're automatically puffed out. Like, you just know that you're bringing over a horse that's going to try. Not necessarily going to win, but that's all you ask them to do is give 110% effort and hope for the best. And yeah. She always did, so that was awesome. And she came back happy and sound all the time too, which was always a big plus.
Yeah, it shows when you look up Broadway Blondie again on Equibase. You can see trained by Edward Acker and owned by Sandra Acker. Was that your grandmother?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
All right. So there you go. Owned and trained by the same family. That is so cool. And that's even more rewarding in some ways, isn't it?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Yeah, so needless to say, I'm pretty sure that's probably my grandfather's favorite horse, too. But I'm going to share that with him.
Yeah, that's pretty great. Yeah. Broadway Blondie, New York bred, New York bred daughter of Shimatori. How about that name?
Yeah, I was just going to ask. I forgot who she was by. Shimatori.
Shimatori out of a Lucky Colonel S mare by the name of Proximal is what it's showing here.
Huh. Yeah. Not much pedigree, I don't think, but she was like one of a kind.
Yeah, pretty cool stuff. So after you left your grandfather's operation, you decided to move on to some bigger barns. Where did you go?
Yeah. I actually went to work for Eddie Clouston.
Okay.
Who is leading trainer, I believe, for the last few years at Mountaineer still. And he had a pretty big operation. He was a younger kind of trainer then, and he had probably about 30, 40 horses. And that was back in the days when Mountaineer was just getting the slot machine. So you're running nickel claimers for 28,000, 29,000. The purses were just ridiculous. So needless to say, a lot of people from Finger Lakes and within driving distance were shipping out to run there than run at wherever they were based out of.
Yeah.
And eventually Eddie moved his whole operation to Mountaineer, and I moved to Mountaineer and stayed there for about a year and a half with him.
How'd you like Mountaineer as opposed to Finger Lakes? Yeah, how'd you like working at Mountaineer as opposed to Finger Lakes?
It wasn't home, but it was an experience. You know, I thought it was kind of neat. Dale Barrett was still there at mm-hmm. the time when I was there, so he's still the most winningest trainer, I believe.
Yeah,
and that was pretty neat to see like operations like that, and which is what I wanted to do. I was 17, 18, right around there. And it was just, everything I saw was just like, oh, wow, look at this. Oh, wow, look at that. So it was awesome.
Did you ever have any conversations with Dale Baird?
No, not personally. I just stood back and watched.
What do you think the one or two traits are that all successful trainers have in common, Scott?
Not to stress out so much. Like, I feel like, Gary said, I think he says it the best. He's got a lot of good saying, but he was always like, it's called damage control. You know what I mean? It's not who can do the best job. It's who can do the best job when something goes wrong. Because in this business, if they're living, breathing creatures, things are going to happen. People work with them. They get, you know, things happen. So it's whoever manages their the damage control the best, basically.
Yeah.
I feel like those guys are the most successful in this business.
Yeah, it's interesting. You said your grandfather always wanted to have a smaller operation where he could be there and see all the horses every day, put his hands on them. Are you kind of cut from the same cloth in that respect?
It doesn't hurt my feelings to do it, but no, not so much. I mean, and that's where Gary kind of came into play. When I worked for him, we had maybe 150, 160 horses.
Mm-hmm.
So it was virtually impossible to do that every day. But we would pull them out every once a week and look them over with a fine-tooth comb for sure. But, you learn how to operate. I mean, if you're going to run at a high level like that, you need to have people that you trust that basically do that job for you. So,
how many horses do you have right now?
I can do either or.
How many horses do you have right now, Scott?
Right now I only have three.
Okay. What's the ultimate goal? What would you like to be at?
Any number. It doesn't bother me. Right now, I'm happy at three. I'd be happy with 300, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, that creates a few more headaches.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, I know, right.
But no, like you said, you got the experience working with Gary. David, maybe not quite as many horses as a guy like Gary Contessa, who at that time was really rolling when you were working with him. Let's go there. Tell me about being introduced to Gary Contessa. Where did that relationship begin?
Well, I'll never forget. I was actually long story short, I ended up working for Kelly Breen at Monmouth Park, and I went to Aqueduct for Kelly. And Kelly went back to Monmouth, and I needed a job. I wanted to stay in New York. I, you know, top-class horses. I was like, you know what? This is where I need to be. So I went, and actually Matt Musiker, who is the agent for Tyler Gaffalione and used to be an agent for A. Barcoa.
Yeah. Javier, too, right? Didn't he have Javier?
And Javier, yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
Probably one of the best agents. He hooked me up with Gary. He got me like a little interview, and Gary took it from there.
Wow. So tell me about being around his operation. What was that like?
It was overwhelming, to say the least, at first, because I had never done anything like that. Like at Finger Lakes, like I said, Eddie had 40 horses, but we had Walker machines, and this is totally different, totally different. So with Gary, he kind of threw you right in there. He wanted to see what you could do, and then he kind of molded me into what he needed me to be throughout time, which was kind of cool. I didn't know he was doing it, but he did it.
And what was that? What did he mold you into?
He kind of made it to the, like, he knew who he had working for him and what they were capable of doing, but he didn't necessarily break you down. He just made you into a stronger person, I like to say, to be able to, you know, weather the things that, if you're going to be an assistant, you're an assistant because you need to take part control of what Gary's responsibilities, you know what I mean? So he wants you to do the same as he would do if he was in the same position. So he came up under Frank Martin. So I think that was kind of like a hard knock type schooling that he went through too. And he kind of does the same thing with his help.
Yeah. You were working with Gary when he set the record in New York, right? Didn't he set the record for the number of wins or something?
Yeah. The most wins in Naira circuit. And it was, for Gary, it was really special because it was Frank Martin, his mentor, was the current holder of the record, and he surpassed him. So that was really neat.
Wow. Wow. How cool was that to be part of that whole scenario?
It was awesome. I mean, like I said, that's why I think I could do 300 horses, because when you're at that point, it's just you eat, sleep, and breathe horses and stall numbers and condition books and everything. But it's so much fun. I mean, every day you're putting 5-6 horses on a van to go run. It's exciting.
Yeah, one thing about Gary is that he always, when he has this kind of success, he's good about acknowledging the fact that it takes a full team to get these things accomplished. And that was one of the things
absolutely.
In that article that I read about him setting the record, he made a point to thank all of his assistants, you included, and all of his riders, his grooms, the foreman. He went through the whole list of people in that article, and it was fantastic that he recognized that, you know?
Yeah, he's good like that. Yeah, he's really... He's awesome. Good guy.
What are some of your favorite moments? I don't know. I'll go this way. What are some of your favorite Gary Contessa stories?
Oh, man.
That you can tell on radio.
No, I'm going to have to think. And I wish I could do Gary's accent of Frank Martin. Most of the stories, unfortunately, came when someone messed something up. And he'd go down memory lane and be like, well, if this is Frank Martin's barn, you wouldn't be able to do that. He'd take a wall box off and throw it across the shed row or something. And I'm like, oh God. But yeah, those are pretty funny stories.
I asked you about your grandfather's horses and the more special ones that you remember from being around your grandfather's operation. How about with Gary's operation? Are there a couple of horses that stand out to you?
Oh yeah. Count for the Gold. No, well, Magnolia Jackson was really cool. She was a neat horse to be around. When I first started there, she was there, and that was awesome. We had we had so many. I like Poppy Chulo too. He didn't really do much for us. I think we might have won $100,000 stake with him, but he was a really neat horse to be around.
Yeah, you know, Magnolia Jackson.
So many.
I don't know if you realize this, but Magnolia Jackson is actually Gary's all-time leading earner. Think about
is
that.
Is she really? Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Sure. According to what I'm seeing here on Equibase, I'm actually looking right now, $536,598 in career earnings. Grade 2 winner, won the Bed of Roses, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's showing that, and I'm surprised by that because I know he's had some really good horses over the years, and she tops the list.
No kidding. And well, 85 and a 50, that was the one I was trying to think. He was probably one of the fastest horses I've ever seen, I think, in the mornings for sure.
85 and a 50.
He made it look so easy. Yeah.
So what was Gary's training philosophy? You said he could be a little bit of a tough teacher, but you're thankful that he was that way. What was his philosophy on training horses?
His philosophy was more or less, you know, he's a good, very good caretaker as well of the horses. He never wanted to push them to do any more than they needed to do.
Mm-hmm.
But he definitely didn't let them let up on themselves either. You know what I mean? Like, I've been multiple times, the riders would have a bad breeze. We might have breezed like 55, and they're supposed to go in 50. Gary would wait a couple of days, and he'd breeze them again, and they would go much better. And not only for physical reasons, I think a lot of it has to do with mental reasons too. I mean, they're still living, breathing creatures and creatures of habit. So you got to teach them every day, you know, horse trainer.
Yeah.
Train them.
Yeah, and it must have been great for you being in New York around all the top trainers in the sport there. You mentioned when you were at Mountaineer and studying guys like Dale Beard, and you would just sit back and watch. Were there trainers like that in New York too that you would just sit back and keep an eye on them when you were working with Gary?
Yeah, but I was so busy, I had to just keep an eye on us and Gary.
Yeah.
It was, yeah. But I understand what you're saying. I think at the time, Gary was that guy to sit back and watch, I thought. So I was just proud to be part of that operation.
How do trainers manage so many horses when they have horses in multiple barns and multiple locations?
That brings me back to the whole, like, how he kind of, like, molds you into what he needs you to be. Like, you need a good assistant, basically. Whoever works under you, you have to be able to carry the load.
Yeah, and he mentioned,
and that's how those guys get it done. I mean, Todd, all those guys have, all their assistants are basically trainers. I mean, they could train on their own tomorrow. So,
yeah.
You got to have good help.
Yeah, and that article that I referenced where he set the record, he also mentioned exercise riders, and I think that's such an important factor for a trainer, a successful trainer certainly, is to have good exercise riders and good communication with those exercise riders, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, Gary, and that was the thing. There's a lot of big barns where I don't think the trainers necessarily talk so much to the riders, but Gary's barn wasn't like that. Like, I mean, I remember I'd have 12, 15 riders in one set every day, just keep rolling out. But the office door was always open. Like, you could go in there and say, "Hey, Gary, you know what? Maybe we should try this with the horse and this and that." And like, he was very good about working with everybody.
Yeah, yeah. I remember interviewing Todd Pletcher one morning at Palm Meadows a few years back. And it was kind of the same situation where he had a series of exercise riders that would come out for his next set that he was getting ready. And Todd walked down and checked the legs of every single horse before they went out. And then each of the exercise riders came walking out of the room across the way as if they were coming out of a jock's room. And they were in single file. And I'm thinking, this is the greatest operation in the history of thoroughbred racing right here.
He's got it down. Absolutely.
Yeah, pretty incredible. Yeah. I'm talking with trainer Scott Acker here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Scott, stay with me. We have to get to the break here at the bottom of the hour. We'll come back and we'll continue our conversation about your life and your career. We'll talk about working with trainer David Fox on the other side of this break. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. The Fasig Tipton Gulfstream Sale is hotter than ever. The nation's premier two-year-olds in training sale is now accepting nominations for the 2020 sale. In 2019, the sale recorded a record average, record median, and sold more horses for $1 million or more than any other two-year-old sale in North America, including a $3.65 million sale topper that was the most expensive two-year-old sold in North America since 2006. Nominate today, the Fasig Tipton Gulfstream Sale, April 1st, 2020, at Gulfstream Park. Where will you be?
Bloom Racing. Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Pulling away from Come Dancing, Mopetism, and the others, Midnight Bizou leaves no doubt today. She won the FIPS in hand.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now, get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
alternation is unbeatable here at Oaklawn, and he stamps himself as a legitimate top horse in the country.
Alternation has what top breeders seek: physicality, race performance, pedigree. This most attractive son of distorted humor is out of a stakes-winning daughter of Seattle Slough and hails from a top Pin Oak family. Millionaire and graded stakes winner, Alternation won and placed in both starts at 2, then won graded stakes at 3 and 4. Alternation standing at Pin Oak Stud.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Olsen has Sarasota Boy in with a shot, now up into a joint second. Trying to run home from the back, Jefe Grande in on the far outside Mountain Tree with a quarter of a mile left to go. It's Sarasota Boy who gets first run to take the lead. Mr. Impressive tries to kick back for a little bit more, second. Three clear of Jefe Grande, third and an eighth of a mile from home. It's Sarasota Boy the leader. Sarasota Boy by 2.5. Mountain Tree down the center with Jefe Grande and Mr. Impressive. But if you back the 15-1 shot Sarasota Boy, you can go collect. Sarasota Boy and Fanny Olsen by 2.5. Mountain Tree second, Jefe Grande third, Mr. Impressive fourth, close for fifth, odds get even, might have hung on.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna in our Jimmy Johns of Lexington broadcast studios, and that was Pete Aiello with the call of race number one at Gulfstream Park back on December 6th. A huge win for Sarasota Boy and for our special guest on the program tonight, TS trainer Scott Acker. That was his first career victory and the first of many more to come, no doubt. Going to get back with Scott here in just a second, but want to remind you that if you are just joining us and you missed any portion of this show for whatever reason, head over to our website. That's horseracingradio.net. You can check out a podcast of this show, all of our Trainer Talk shows, and all of our programs for that matter. You can do that at your leisure, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts, another way that you can access the programs if you miss them live. But yeah, what a win for Scott Acker. We talked about it right off the bat in the first half of the program, and he said he didn't bet on it, but well, that's okay. Maybe his parents did, because they're big fans of all of his horses too. Scott, welcome back to the program, man.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, that little call right there has to bring back some good memories, huh?
Yeah, it kind of gave me goosebumps again. I don't know why, but I guess it's the passion.
Will you go back and watch the replay of that race? Have you done that?
Oh, my God, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. If he had lost, I would have watched the replay 20 times. So
how many times have you watched it now?
This one, I mean, only a few times. I don't want to keep critiquing it too much and downgrading it. So
that's interesting. What would you be looking for if he got beat? What are you looking for when you watch that replay so many times?
Well, how did he get beat? Did I get him beat? Did he get himself beat? Did jockey get in trouble? You know, just all those, try to rule out all those kind of variables and then see what you have to do to get ready for the next start. And like I said, I mean, I've been around a lot of guys now and I've learned some things. Like, there's winning a race, and then there's winning the race the right way and winning, like, a good race. And that was a good win, like I said before, but still, he's got a lot. He's still got a lot to learn. He's still green and kind of shy and stuff like that. So we've been working on other things now. Hopefully for the next start, he'll be a little bit more mature.
How does a trainer know from watching the replay if you were the one that got the horse beat and not the jockey and not the circumstances of the race?
I say that meaning, you know, was he unfit? Was he moving fluidly, soundly, you know, naturally? Everything, was everything good like that? Was there too much blinker? Was there no blinkers? Or was it wrong bit, tongue tie? You know, just all the equipment, things like that.
Wow. How do you keep from second guessing yourself?
It's not easy. But yeah, you get used to it, I think.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. I mean, they're living, breathing animals. They're not all the same, so they all require different types of equipment and attention and training. Or at least that's how I go about it.
Yeah, you told me in the first half of the program that it was special and emotional for you, not just for the horse, not just for you as a trainer, but because of the owners, that those were owners that had horses, and maybe still do, I don't know, with David Fox, and they gave you an opportunity with some of their horses. So tell me a little bit more about that relationship.
Yeah, those guys were really good, and I mean, thanks to Dave too. But I actually, when I worked for Dave, I went out. I was like the second string guy. I was in Monmouth. I was in Keeneland, Kentucky, and those particular owners had those caliber of horses that, and more Kentucky breds also. So they had those horses that were gonna, that needed to be at Churchill. So I got to really get to know them more one on one because I was there, and Dave had the big string still in Florida. I mean, he come up and back and forth, but you know, you get to build a relationship with owners like that because you're in control every day, and you're the one that gets to talk to them and tell them how their horses are doing. And I guess Mr. McCarty just, you know, he liked the way that I took care of his horses, and they all ran pretty good too. So he said, anytime I go on my own, he would definitely give me a chance. Thank God he did.
Yeah. Yeah. Now there's Sarasota boy, and you also train Sarasota girl. Is that right?
Yeah, correct.
Okay. All right. Oh, same ownership group? I didn't look that one up.
Yeah,
same owners.
Owner.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Are all three of your horses given to you by the same ownership?
Two of them, and then the other one is not. It's just a private one.
Okay. All right. Do you ever see yourself owning some of the horses that you train, like your grandfather did?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, I've been spitballing around trying to, like, not a major syndicate, but just, like, something small. A couple of my friends are now, you've heard of Always Dreaming.
Yeah.
The son of Anthony Bonomo is a good friend of mine, and actually I got to know him. He was working on at the track at the time, and he left, and he's become a lawyer, and now he's got himself kind of situated, and we were kind of talking about maybe, you know, just a few of us getting in and starting a little stable again and claiming a few. So it's more fun. It's a lot of fun, you know, when it's your friends and stuff like that win too.
Yeah, that's a good point, Scott. How does a trainer go about building up their stable? You said you're happy with three right now, but you'd be happy if you had 300. So what's your approach? Yeah. How do you get set to build up this stable?
You just keep presenting yourself, I think, in the best way possible. And I mean, your horses are your, I guess, business card, for lack of a better word.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, they see your horse. It's a reflection of yourself. Your horses do good, or they look good. You know, you never know whose eye you're going to catch or what owner you're going to run into, and then be like, wow, you know, I like what you do. And that's really how it gets going, I think. And not to put too much pressure on myself to make that happen. I mean, you got to put yourself out there, but you can't make things happen. That's just the way it is.
How about social media or websites? Do you include much of that in terms of trying to get your name out there?
I do try. I do try a lot. Yeah. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, yeah. But I don't have a website yet, and, you know, like, when I won the race, I was so excited. The guy's like, what's your Twitter handle? And I'm like, I don't even know. I couldn't even, I was just so, like, excited. But, yeah, I've gotten into that a little bit more. Obviously, that helps a lot. I mean, I have Acker Racing Stables, and hopefully I meet the right people sooner or later.
That's what, it's Acker Racing Stables on Twitter?
I think it's, yeah, Acker Racing Stables on Twitter.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll have, you know, tens of thousands of people following you now.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Hey, if you get one, let me know. That would be a positive. We'll start building it slowly. So let's get
Acker
back to
Stables. Yeah, Acker Stables.
Okay. There you go. We're talking to Scott Acker, who is our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here this evening. Tell me about your time with David Fox. What was that like?
That was fun, you know, probably more so because it started in Florida. And this is, I love Florida. I don't know why. Maybe it's just the sun. There's something about Florida. I love it here. So I was really excited to work for him because he's a Florida-based guy, and I knew I would always be here. And then, of course, I get sent to Monmouth, which is a very awesome meet. It's a lot of fun. And Dave's a really cool guy. Like, again, he's kind of like Gary Contessa. I mean, he's successful. He knows what. He doesn't hire people that he just to hire them. Like he knows who he's hiring. So all of his assistants were very, very competent, everything. So he was a lot of fun in the sense that, like, he kind of let you do a lot of things. Like, you're there. You're the one that has to, you make first call on that stuff. So he kind of just threw you in there. So I was, like, training without training under my name. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Was his daughter Natalie there at the time too?
Yeah. Yeah. She actually, I think it was my last year, she was just starting to kind of like get full time on the track.
Okay.
But she had like showing horses, and she had a whole other horse thing that she'd been doing for since I don't know how old.
Yeah, she was on this program. She was fantastic when she was on this show.
Yeah, Natalie's great.
What years were you with David?
I think my last year was 14 or 13, I think.
So were you there with the Sheer Drama days?
I just left running? That. Actually, I took Sheer Drama to Maryland, and she won her first stake of her life, $100,000 stake with Trevor McCarthy. And after that, Dave and she went to the farm, and I went to New York and started working there again.
Yeah, he had some great horses around. I mean, he had Duke of Mischief, Bahamian Squall.
That horse is cool, that one, yeah.
Duke of Mischief?
That was a really neat horse. Very cool. Very, yeah. Like, the personality he had. Well, Dave would eat oranges. The horse would nick her. He'd eat oranges. Dave's eating grapes. He'd eat grapes or whatever. It was hysterical. The ice tub, you just turn him loose and he walks. He put himself in the ice tub, knee tub. Like, he was a really neat horse.
Horses will eat grapes and oranges?
Not all of them, apparently. David, I don't know, he stopped at that farm fresh stand or whatever. He's like, oh, yeah, I got some grapes or some bananas or whatever. Duke always had to have something.
Yeah, I love David. You know what I like about David is that he's always, we've become very good friends, but he's always so accommodating. When we were first starting the network and I would be on the backside doing interviews with trainers, he was always the one to invite you into the barn area and to say, hey, do you want to walk the shed row and come see Big Drama or, you know, Little Drama or whatever horse that it was that he had. And I can remember he let me into the stall with Big Drama one time. And I'm really not a horse guy. I'm not good around horses. But somehow he let me in there with Big Drama, and he trusted me enough to do that, which was pretty cool. And I'll never forget that.
Yeah, Dave's got that, I don't know, he's very optimistic. He's got a good energy about him all the time. That's the other thing about with Dave, you know, he was never like really down ever. He was always had a good, his barn always has a happy energy in it. That was really cool about working with him like that.
Does that translate to the horses?
I believe so, 100 times over. Yeah, I think so. Like, even when a barn gets hot, it's not like everyone's like, oh, they must be doing something different. No, I think it's the energy. Like, I've had one horse over in a barn where there's a bunch of empty stalls. They don't want to eat. They don't do this. You put them with a bunch of horses, and they hear one horse starts nickering, the other one feeds off that, and they all of a sudden everybody, and then they clean the tub. You know, it's just one win. I think they know it. You know, they just, it's a good energy. Not even the horses, but the people are happy.
Yeah,
and they do a better job, and they have a better aurora about them, I guess.
I remember being at Saratoga and going to see him before. It might have been the personal ensign when Sheer Drama won. And I went over to interview him before. And we were standing there with Sheer Drama. And he told me, he said, just don't turn your back on her.
Yeah.
And I learned that lesson very quickly with her.
Yeah. Actually, when I took her to Maryland, we were in Saratoga with her. She just, I think, ran in a two other than, and Rosie Napravnik rode her. And she, I think she got boxed in. And she probably should have won that race. But after that, we knew she was going to Maryland, so I had to stay up there, and I had to start grooming her. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, you don't turn your back on Sheer Drama. Not a chance. She'll let you know she's there, that's for sure.
Have you ever been bit by horses?
All the time.
Really?
Yeah. Well, maybe I'm just too trusting sometimes, but, you know, yeah, it happens.
Wow.
They're nippers.
Yeah. Talking with Scott Acker.
Some of them are just straight up mean. But no, usually they just play with each other. They bite each other, but we're just not that tough. I don't have horse hide.
Who's the meanest horse you've ever been around?
Man. It had to be an Eddie Clouston horse. And her name was all tapped out. And it was a filly, of course, but she would jump on you. Like, she'd strike you. She was insane. She could run, too. She was all right.
Yeah. Yeah, do you find that if you try to take that mean streak out of them, that maybe they're not as good on the racetrack in the afternoons?
Some of them, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, just maybe that's what makes them so good.
Their personality. You see, like, athletes, same thing. Some of them are cocky. Some of them are this, laid back, you know. if you know the horse, you just know that that's them. You just don't mess with, like, sheer drama. That's sheer drama. Okay.
Yeah, let her do her thing.
Yeah, let her do her thing. She's doing a good thing.
I'm talking with trainer Scott Acker here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Of course, he worked with so many of the top trainers in the sport, including guys like Kelly Breen and Gary Contessa, and talking about his time with David Fox here before going out on his own. Did David ever take you fishing out on the boat?
You know what? He offered a lot of times, but usually that day that fishing was offered was my only day off of the week or of the 2 weeks. We'd used to alternate days off. So I was like, no, I'm going to spend my day not out on a boat. I'm going to do something now.
What would you do on your day off? What other things do you enjoy doing, Scott?
Oh, that's a good question, because on my days off, it always ended up being like all the things you don't do on the regular day, like laundry, go to the bank, that kind of fun stuff. But, you know, I like to go to hockey games. I like sporting events, concerts, things like that. It's cool.
Yeah, who's your favorite sports team?
My favorite sports team? I like the Gators, Florida Gators.
Yeah. Do you go to any of their football games down there?
No, and they just played over here at Hard Rock, and of course I didn't go because it was going to rain, so I wimped out on that. But no, I have not, and I want to go to the games, though, one of the games in Gainesville. I think that'd be a cool experience.
Yeah. Did you grow up playing sports in high school or anything?
Well, I played baseball for a little bit, but then I played horse racing.
Yeah.
Took up all the rest of my time, which was okay.
Yeah, if people are just joining us, they missed that part of the show when you started talking about the fact that this is all you ever wanted to do, and you did it. You followed your passion right after high school and started working around the racetrack, and it's worked out pretty well for you. Tell me about making that decision to go out on your own. When did that officially happen?
It happened last year, 2000, maybe like in the springtime. I was like, you know what? Mr. McCarty had Sarasota girl, and he had this baby, Sarasota boy, who was still at Kruppi's farm. And he's like, what are you doing? I got a couple Florida breds. I was like, you know what? I'll take them. So then I was like, oh, this will be easy. I'll just go over there and get my trainer's license. No, you have to make an appointment. You have to do this. You have to get workman's comp. I was like, oh, my gosh, this is why I haven't done it yet. Nonetheless, I was pretty fortunate. Gulfstream's great. I love it here. Everybody's very accommodating. The stewards are great. Mr. DeMauro, Steve DeMauro, he's an awesome guy. And Dave Fox. I had to go pull my Dave Fox card. I'm like, Dave, can you help me get a test, blah, blah, blah. I took the test, got my workman's comp, got everything figured out. And I was like, oh, perfect. All right, now here we go.
You know, that's a great point, Scott. I don't think I've ever asked this question or gotten into this conversation with any trainer in the 8 years we've been doing this program. But take me through what you have to do in order to be a licensed horse trainer in the sport of thoroughbred racing.
Yeah, like I said, I thought it was just walk over there and say, can I be a trainer?
Yeah.
I've been an assistant for so long, but I had to start an LLC, which you see it, but I don't even know what that was at the time. So
yep.
I did that, and then you have to get workman's comp. I mean, it's like any other legitimate business in the world. You need to, you know, so as soon as you get that, then Gulfstream checks all that over, and then you got to take a trainer's test, a barn test, and a written test, which, you know, I guess it varies. They said some people take 2-3 hours, some people take 1.5.
What does the test consist of?
Excuse me?
What does the test consist of?
Everything, basically, like, you know, from equipment, a lot of anatomy, you know, that you always have to know, all the parts of the horse. Those are kind of the basics. But the really tricky stuff was like the condition books, which I was like, oh, that'll be my easiest part, which thank God I knew a condition book. But you never think about it, because nowadays when you enter a horse, the weight comes up automatically. It's all computer, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But there on that test, you still have to be like back in the old days. Like when you entered, you have to tell them the weight. And there's, if you look at like graded races, there's certain conditions and parameters. Like a horse that hasn't won over a mile gets 3 pounds. Horses that haven't made X amount of dollars get this many pounds. And you're like, oh wow, now you're doing all this math. You have to be able to read the PPs correctly. And it was actually, I kind of had fun doing it, because I never had to do it like that. But I kind of got nervous too. I was like, am I doing it right? Because usually you're just like, I'll put so-and-so in this race. And they're like, all right, you get 124 or whatever. I'm like, okay.
Who makes the determination
kind of
grades the test and tells you if you passed or failed?
Excuse me?
Who makes the determination if you passed or failed the test?
The stewards. I believe the stewards go through it and grade it.
Okay.
And come to find out, it's not even the same test. So they're varied. Like, the questions aren't the same on everyone's test. So that's kind of neat, too.
So if you go and train in a different state, if you want to train horses in New Jersey, say, and go back to Monmouth Park, would you need to get workman's comp insurance in New Jersey, or is the policy you have now applicable?
No, I would need to get it in New Jersey. However, that's the cool thing about Jersey is they pay your workman's comp.
Okay.
Now, I don't know if you just get a paper that says I'm in New Jersey and they pay my workman's comp or not, but that's a big plus about Monmouth Park. They pay the workman's comp, which attracts a lot of people, plus their purses and the caliber of horses they get.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and any other state, like Kentucky or something like that, I would have to go through my insurance company. If they didn't cover me, I guess you'd have to figure out another company that does cover you for Kentucky.
Boy, that's fascinating. I didn't realize the entire process that goes into becoming a horse trainer. You don't just show up and say, I want to be a horse trainer, obviously, as you just so eloquently pointed out. But have you known, and you don't have to name names, certainly, but have you known individuals who have tried to go through the test and failed and had to go back and try it again?
Yeah, absolutely.
Really?
And that was, and then here's the catch part, is they said if you fail, you can't take it again for 6 months. I was like, excuse me? Meanwhile, I already told Mr. McCarty, send the horses, put them on the stand, let's do this. I thought I was going to be a breeze. Oh, my goodness. I almost had a heart attack, so thank God. Like I said, the steward, everybody was really accommodating. It was really nice. Gulfstream's a great spot.
And, yeah.
They graded it the next morning. I knew by 11 o'clock in the morning if I passed or failed, and that was it.
Yeah, that's great. Well, congratulations on that. That's pretty cool. And, again, yeah, things starting off on a high note for you, and I'm sure many more good things to come. Are you stabled at Gulfstream right now?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. All right. That racetrack, people seem to be pretty happy with that racetrack down there.
Yeah, it's neat. I mean, you can't beat the weather, obviously. And, yeah, they do a great job on it, I think. I mean, look at Safi Joseph. Most of his horses train here, and I know his good ones train here. And he's had some good ones this year, too.
Yeah, what a role he's on. He was on the show with me last week on our Equine Forum show, and, boy, I'm so happy for Safi.
Yeah, me too. That was awesome. He had a big day the other day, three stake wins. Yeah, me too. And then come to find out, like, 2 days later, it was his birthday, and I was like, oh, man, how old is Safi? He's like 32 or 33. I was like, what?
Yeah, he's just a kid. Did he ever tell you he trained a Triple Crown winner?
Where, in Barbados?
Yeah.
No, but I think I knew that.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Yep. Talking with Scott Acker here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. All right, so you've worked with all of the notable trainers we've talked about, but if you could hang out with one trainer in this sport for a full day and just be around them and watch them and talk to them and ask them anything you wanted to ask them, Scott, what trainer would it be?
Probably Lucas.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I catch myself, any article that Lucas is in, I always read it. Anytime I hear an interview with Lucas, I always listen to it. Like, he's just got a way with words, which I envy. Just the way he says things and his demeanor and everything, I idolize that. And when I was a kid, he was the man. So it's just kind of like, yeah, he'd probably be definitely that guy.
Yeah, he's one of my favorite interviews. Guys like him and Baffert and Todd and, you know, the top trainers in the sport.
Yeah, Baffert's very good too, well-versed.
Yeah. I mean, they start talking. I don't even want to ask a question. I just want to sit back and listen because there's so many good sound bites and so much they can tell you. And if you're talking, you're not listening, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, what question do you think you'd ask Wayne if you could have one question to ask him? What do you think it would be?
How do you lose? How to lose well? If that makes any sense. like we're in a sport where if you're betting 25%, that's good. So you're losing 75% of the time. So basically, you got to be a good loser. And, you know, I don't know how that kind of sounds dumb, I guess, in a way, but it's the reality of it. Like, yeah, they might run good, but you lose a lot of the time. So how do you keep yourself going? How do you keep your head high? What do you do to just keep trying to get better, basically?
Is that hard to do? Scott, is that difficult to do?
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah, I think so, because you put too much pressure on yourself, and it's not healthy, it's not good, and that's where that negative energy starts. That's what you don't want. That, like, that's where I think Dave is good. It's like, all right, back to the drawing board. Let's get him next time. You know what I mean? And that, I like that part. That's cool. But Lucas has done it for a long time, and he still does it. I'd love to pick his brain.
Yeah, he's brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. And so many things with that wealth of knowledge that he could share with any trainer, any young trainer that's getting involved in the sport.
Yeah.
How about you? If a young trainer comes up to Scott Acker and says, "Hey, I want to try doing this for a living," what do you tell him?
Good luck. Basically, I mean, yeah. If they're saying that, they probably already know. Hopefully, they know what it entails and what you need, and what kind of passion and work ethic, a lot of work ethic you need to, that goes into it. So if they're saying that, that's all you can say. And I like that too. Like I like all the trainers to win. It doesn't really bother me. I don't have like least favorite trainers. I see people at the races all the time. Oh, I hope he doesn't win. Who cares? I mean, they're working just like we are.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not like athletes where trainers don't have arch rivals necessarily.
Well, there are some. I mean, don't get me wrong, especially in the claiming game. You know what I mean? Or owners switch their horses to that trainer and stuff like that. Now, maybe if that happens, I'm not going to slap my leg super hard and hope that they get home. But, yeah, I mean, it is what it is. They're just trying to make a living and do the best they can.
Well, Scott, listen, we're just about out of time. About 1 minute left. I've got to wrap it up. So really want to thank you for taking the time here on Trainer Talk tonight. Been a delight to hear your story. Really enjoyable visit. And all the best moving forward, my friend.
I really appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, great stuff. He is Trainer Scott Acker. Remember his name. He is just getting started. Again, just 3 horses right now. He said he'd be happy with 300. Be careful what you wish for. That may come someday for Scott Acker. I'm sure he'd be very, very good if he had that many horses too. He seems like he has a good handle on things and on this profession. Don't forget, if you missed any portion of the show, just head over to our site. That's horseracingradio.net. Listen to the podcast at your leisure. We'd love to hear from you too. Follow us on social media. Tweet to us anytime at HRN Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook and on Instagram. And of course, you can email the show, mike@horseracingradio.net. Now for my special guest, Scott Acker, for our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next week on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Thanks for listening.